Hey, Redemption Church, how are y'all doing? No, that was a little weak, but okay. Hey, I'm glad you guys are here. I'm thankful that you guys are here. As you can tell, I'm not Carter. Carter is on a well-deserved break this week. Him and his family are on the way to the beach today on this nice rainy day. It's a great day to go to the beach, but that's where they're headed. And so I get to finish up the sermon series for us today, which, you know, they say that you save the best for last, right? I guess we'll see which one is true today. And so, for those that do not know me, my name is Jacob. I'm one of the pastors here. And to start today, guys, I want to tell you a story that literally happened yesterday, okay? I want to tell you about an experience I had with my internet provider, which, for most of you guys that have ever had to deal with an internet provider, you're probably thinking, oh, great, here comes the horror story. Here comes that terrible customer experience, and this is just going to be terrible, but at the same time, great. This is actually not one of those stories. It's actually the opposite. It's a good story for once about an internet provider. And see, so I had to go to Cox's store over by Valley View yesterday to replace my modem because my modem stopped working. Had no power to it at all. It stopped working. And so I went over there. And guys, before I went over there, I started to complain and question, why do I got to do this? Why do I got to do this thing that I do not want to do? I'm dreading it. Why is this happening to me? And it's my day off. This is just terrible. And guys, that tone I'm using right now is not the tone I was using yesterday. Don't judge me. I know you've been there if you've had to deal with Cox before. And so I get there early so I can be one of the first people in and out of the store. And they open at 10 a.m., so I get there about 9:45, and I'm the second person in line. And so I walk through the door, and a guy greets me and asks me, what's going on? And so I tell him, hey, I need a new modem. The power's not working. I've already talked to somebody online and all that. And so he said, cool, come with me. We go to his computer. He pulls up my account, and he asked me to confirm how much I am spending every month to Cox, which at this point I'm just like, thanks for reminding me of that information, dude. I appreciate that. And I start thinking, here we go, this dude's going to start selling me some things that I don't need. But he looks at me and he says, hey man, I can get you faster internet for less money with upgraded equipment. I look back at him. I wish I could have seen my face at this point, because all I could say to him was, yeah, let's do that. And so, guys, he rings everything up. He gives me the equipment. I walk out of the store at 10:06 a.m. I was literally in there for 6 minutes, okay? Just incredible. It was the best experience in an internet provider store I've ever had. Maybe anybody's ever had. But I got in my car and I started to drive away. And it really got me thinking about how many times is it like that in my life with God? You know, circumstances happen. And I start complaining and I question, why is this happening? All the while, God is just patiently waiting and saying, I know the plans I have for you. I'm right here and I'm for your good. Just trust me. And so that's what we're going to talk about today, that God is working on our behalf for our good. And what we have seen through the life of Abraham is that God is for us, not against us. And that is the main point for today, if you're a note taker, it's that God is for us, not against us. Because his will is that we would prosper, not wither and worry through this life. I mean, Jesus himself said, I have come to give you life and have it abundantly. And as we can see in stories like today, not just the New Testament, but in the Old Testament, in stories like today, that God is for us. He wants us to prosper. Now, that prospering may look a little different than we envision. It may not be exactly the way we want, and we're going to talk about that a little later. But for now, let's take a look back at what God has been doing through the life of Abraham and how he has shown himself faithful over and over again. Let's see how quickly I can do this. Probably not pretty quickly. So we started in Genesis 12 about 8 weeks ago, where we see Abram and Sarai. They're living in their home country. And they are comfortable, they have wealth, they have family around them to support them.
But they have no children of their own because Sarai was, she was barren, which that means a little bit different back in their context than it does in today's context. It would mean two things for Sarai and her family. It would, one, mean that there was shame upon her and her family. And the reason why was because being a mother was viewed as the primary role for women. And people believed in that time that if you could not have children, it was because God had cursed you for some sin or wrongdoing in your life. And then the second thing it would mean, it meant that there was no future or legacy. Because no kids means no continuation of the family. And so this is where Abram and Sarai are. They are living comfortably but in shame and without hope for the future. But God shows up and tells Abram to trust him. And God promises to bless Abram by making a great nation from Abraham or Abram's lineage. So they pick up and leave. And God tells them to set up shop in the land of Canaan. Then God promises Abram that his descendants will be as many as the dust on the earth. Abram gets blessed by Melchizedek, which I got to say is the coolest name ever. I tried to name our son that. That got shot down. So, but Abram is blessed to be a blessing. In Genesis 15, Abram is doubtful and afraid about the future. But God shows up and he's faithful and he reassures Abram of his promise. God reminds him that he's going to make Abram's descendants as numerous as the sky or stars in the sky. However, Abram and Sarah both decide to take things into their own hands. They decide to use their servant Hagar for their means to have a child. And they either forget about God's promises or they just don't care and they give in to wickedness. But God protects Hagar from their wickedness. And again, we see God confront Abram and shows him grace by continuing this covenant or promise that he has made with him. And Abram and Sarai, they both get new names, Abraham and Sarah. And Abraham is promised offspring that will make up nations, that kings will come from this nation. He's promised land. They're promised a son, and his name is to be Isaac. And on top of all that, he's promised that he gets to remain with God forever. All pretty good promises, right? You'd think they'd be like happy and all after this. But what we see right after this is we see Sarah laugh at God, which is probably not the smartest move, but she does. And she does it because she believes that she is too old. And then in Genesis 20, Abraham lies to a king about Sarah being his sister for the second time. And he does this because he is afraid and isn't trusting God to take care of him. But God still protects him. And then we finally see this promised offspring born. And after a while, God tests Abraham's faith by asking Abraham to sacrifice Isaac. And Abraham finally trusts God, and God provides a ram to be sacrificed. Then we see the death of Sarah in Genesis 23, and Abraham mourns her death. And I think through mourning her death, Abraham starts thinking about his legacy, about that promise that God made him to make his descendants as numerous as the stars, which brings us to today's passage, Genesis 24. And for the rest of today's sermon, we are going to talk about Abraham sending his servant to find his son Isaac a wife, which is very interesting. This isn't how I found a wife. It's probably not how most of you found a spouse. But this is the way they did it back then, and it's still done in many places in the world. Isaac and Rebekah is the next story next step in the story. Abraham's story continues through his descendants. And so today, I'm going to walk through the passage. We're going to make a couple observations, and then we will end today with one big point to walk away with. And so we're going to start in Genesis 24, verse 1, if you want to read along with me, or it'll be on the screen. Now Abraham was old, well advanced in years, and the Lord had blessed Abraham in all things. And Abraham said to his servant, the oldest of his household, who had charge of all that he had, put your hand under my thigh, that I may make you swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and God of the earth, that you will not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites, among whom I dwell, but will go to my country and to my kindred and take a wife for my son Isaac. The servant said to him, perhaps the woman may not be willing to follow me to this land. Must I then take your son back to the land from which I came? Abraham said to him, see to it that you do not take my son back there. The Lord, the God of heaven, who took me from my father's house and from the land of my kindred, and who spoke to me and swore to me, to your offspring I will give this land. He will send his angel before you, and you shall take a wife for my son from there. But if the woman is not willing to follow you, then you will be free from this oath of mine. Only you must not take my son back there. So the servant put his hand under the thigh of Abraham, his master, and swore to him concerning this matter. So let's just pause there for a couple minutes. The first observation that I would like to point out is that Abraham is old, but he is also engaging in the promise. And the reason I point this out is because a lot of times when death is near, when we're near the end of our life, we start to think about the future. We think about what we're going to leave behind, our kids, inheritances, what people think about us, what we've achieved, you know, how we've helped people. It's our legacy, right? And this is where Abraham is. Sarah just died. He's old, and he knows that his time is limited. But he's not sitting idly, which, let me just say a quick point to you that consider yourself old. I'm not calling you old here. This is if you consider yourself old. So this is for you to judge, guys. A quick point is that you still have time to impact the people around you. Don't sit idly. God can still use you in the mission. Abraham was old here, but he was still impacting the people around him. He was still active, and you can be too. God can still use you. Don't sit idly. So back to the point, Abraham is old, but he's not sitting idly, nor is he working out of his own wisdom anymore. And we know this because Abraham is very specific about how the servant is to find a wife. There's two instructions here about how to find a wife. One, he's not to find a Canaanite woman. The reason why is faith. Because the Canaanites did not believe in the true God. They did not have faith in God. And this is a story about bringing a people into the family of God. It's about a people of faith. And then two, the servant is to go to Israel and bring an Israelite woman back to the land of Canaan. And why? It's because of the promised land. This is about bringing the girl into the promise, not about going backward into comfort and security. So it's specific, and it goes back to, does Abraham believe that God's promises are true and good? Which I would argue here, he does. I mean, even when the servant asks, well, what if this girl won't come back with me? Abraham responds by believing the promise that was made to him by God. He's trusting that the Lord is going to provide. He's following the instruction. He believes that God is for him, not against him. And he's not fearful like we've seen in the past with Abraham. He's leaning into the promise and acting out in faith that the ways of God are true and good. And so a quick question for us today is, do you believe that God's ways are the best ways? Are you leaning into the promises of God, or are you leaning into your own understanding? Just some questions to help you gauge which side you're on. Are you honest and open with the decision-making in your life with Christian community? Discipleship happens in community. In your community groups, are you vulnerable and honest with others? Because if you're not, that's a good indication that you're leaning on your own understanding. How well do you suffer? Does suffer draw you closer to God or further from God? Do you get angry? Do you question why God would allow this circumstance without even ever going to prayer with him? If so, that could be an indicator that you're leaning into your own understanding. So that was my first observation from this section. My second is the whole hand under the thigh thing. Right? And when I read those guys for the first time, I got the basics of what's going on, right? And even if this is a little awkward, we need the whole picture to really understand what the meaning of this chapter is. And the basics is that Abraham is wanting his servant to make an oath to him that he will find a wife for Isaac. But there's a little more here to this than that. You know, like, for instance, why the thigh? Why do you have to put his hands under the thigh? Like, why couldn't he give a handshake? You know, or make an oath in writing? Maybe a hug? Like, I feel like that's a viable option, right? Like, give a hug, yes, I'll do this for you, kind of thing. But he didn't. And that's because there is meaning even in the placement of the hands under the thigh, which to me speaks to the meaning of this chapter. When Abraham says, put your hand under my thigh, he does not mean just like the tips of the fingers under the outer thigh. No, Abraham is saying to a servant, hey, come in here. I got a mission for you. But before you go, put your hands here. He is saying, put your hands up under my thighs. Guys, in today's culture, this is a good way to get arrested. Okay? It's an HR nightmare. So if you're a boss, do not do this. Okay? In saying, put his hand under the thigh, the author is using a little bit of a euphemism. By put your hand under my thigh, he meant, well, exactly where you think he meant. And before you think I'm just being crude or making things up, most scholars actually say it was a bit more graphic than what we even think. One Hebrew commentator said this. He said, the thigh is a euphemism for the genitive organ upon which the sign of circumcision was also placed. And so Abraham did this because he wanted to let the servant know that this mission is about offspring. This is about the promise that God made to Abraham. What I'm sending you on is about offspring. It's not just about my son's happiness. It's not about just doing what I tell you to do. It's about descendants that outnumber the stars. It's important. So I do not want you to forget it. So put your hands here and make an oath. And you guys, I did a bunch of studying for this. Most pastors preach this chapter. They preach on marriage, which let me say, it's not wrong. It's not wrong to preach marriage about a you know, these two people coming together, Isaac and Rebekah. There is an order in God's design to have offspring. Isaac must have a wife. He must get married. But to me, and let me emphasize, to me, the emphasis is not on marriage. It's on the offspring. It's on the promise of offspring. And this promise of offspring is about God's will being fulfilled. It's God working out his plan through space and time. It's about a plan that God set in motion in the Garden of Eden. God created man and woman for a relationship with him, and because of sin, that relationship was broken. But even amidst Adam and Eve sinning against God, God promised to redeem and restore his creation. And this promise of offspring for Abraham is the process of fulfilling that restoration. This union between Isaac and Rebekah are the next steps in the grand story of the gospel. It's the next steps in God's plan. And Isaac and Rebekah will have children who have children. And out of those children will come Jesus, the Savior of the world. And through Jesus, descendants outnumbering the stars will come into the family of God, not by physical birth, but by spiritual birth. And God's still working out that plan today to bring a people to himself. That's his will for us, is to know him. It's not, you know, what school I'm going to go to. It's not what job I'm going to get. It's not who I'm going to marry. It's not what neighborhood I'm going to live in. It's to know him and glorify him. I think God's will is just summed up beautifully in Micah 6:8. It says this, he has shown you, O mortal, what is good. And what is required from the Lord? To act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. Guys, did you see that? It's not just to act justly or to love mercy or to walk humbly, even though those things are good and we should do them because they are good, but it's to do them with your God. Because God's will is that his children would know him and commune with him forever. And that happens through faith in Jesus, and Jesus comes from this promised offspring. So this passage is about offspring, and we need not forget that. I know that's a lot for what seems a little detail about a thigh and an oath, and I wish I could sit here and keep going because there's a whole lot more we could say about that, but I have 57 verses to go, and so we got to move on. All right, so let's continue reading. There's a lot of verses, so stick with me. We're going to read verses 10 through 28, and it says, "Then the servant took 10 of his master's camels and departed, taking all sorts of choice gifts from his master, and he arose and went to Mesopotamia, to the city of Nahor. And he made the camels kneel down outside the city by the well of water at the time of evening, the time when women would go out to draw water. And he said, 'O Lord, God of my master Abraham, please grant me success today and show steadfast love to my master Abraham. Behold, I am standing by the spring of water, and the daughters of the men of the city are coming out to draw water. Let the young woman to whom I shall say, please let down your jar that I may drink, and who shall say, drink, and I will water your camels, let her be the one whom you have appointed for your servant Isaac. By this I shall know that you have shown steadfast love to my master.' Before he had finished speaking, behold, Rebekah, who was born to Bethuel, the son of Milcah, the wife of Nahor, Abraham's brother, came out with her water jar on her shoulder. The young woman was very attractive in appearance, a maiden whom no man had known. She went down to the spring and filled her jar and came up. Then the servant ran to meet her and said, 'Please give me a little water to drink from your jar.' She said, 'Drink, my lord.' And she quickly let down her jar upon her hand and gave him a drink. When she had finished giving him a drink, she said, 'I will draw water for your camels also until they have finished drinking.' So she quickly emptied her jar into the trough and ran again to the well to draw water. And she drew for all his camels. The man gazed at her in silence to learn whether the Lord had prospered his journey or not. When the camels had finished drinking, the man took a gold ring weighing a half shekel and two bracelets for her arms weighing 10 gold shekels and said, 'Please tell me whose daughter you are. Is there room in your father's house for us to spend the night?' She said to him, 'I am the daughter of Bethuel, the son of Milcah, whom she bore to Nahor.' She added, 'We have plenty of both straw and fodder and room to spend the night.' The man bowed his head and worshiped the Lord and said, 'Blessed be the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his steadfast love and his faithfulness towards my master. As for me, the Lord has led me in the way to the house of my master's kinsman.' Then the young woman ran and told her mother's household about these things." Okay, let's just pause there again for a second. The first 9 verses, we see Abraham telling the servant about the task, the mission. Now we see the servant going to fulfill that mission. And in this section, there's 2 things I would like us to see. 1, the servant's petition, and then God's provision. You know, we see in the verses twice the servant goes to God in prayer. He makes a petition to God on behalf of the mission because the servant knows that he alone cannot fulfill the task set before him. It's a needle in the haystack. But he goes to God and asks. And then the Lord answers the prayer, and his response is prayer and praise. He rejoiced at what the Lord did and talks to God. This shows both a dependence on God and correspondence with God. He relied on God and had a relationship with God. It wasn't just a transaction for him. It was a joy to commune with God, a joy to talk to God. A lot of times I remember about the dependence part, but forget about the relational aspect with God. And guys, this week I read an article from a guy named Jeremy Lineman on the Gospel Coalition website about prayer. And he said one of the first things he asked Christians is, what does your prayer life look like? And a lot of times, he said, the majority of times, he said people drop their heads and they admit their prayer life isn't what they want it to look like, what it should be. And I suspect if I were to ask you guys that same question today, the majority of you would probably do the same. And that's because we feel guilt and shame that our prayer life isn't as good as it ought to be. It doesn't meet some kind of standard, which then keeps us from praying more to God. The servant is an example of what a praying life looks like. It's one that is filled with joy because of the freeing relationship that we get with God. This is what Jeremy Lineman had to say in his article. We all live with a gap between who we are and who we want to be. There's a gap between where we are today and where we hope to be in a later stage of maturity. This gap can lead us to feel guilt and shame, or it can serve as an invitation to a deeper life, to pray and to get started now. God invites us to know and enjoy him in prayer. It's the place we meet with God and discover his healing and peace. Therefore, the major work of prayer has already been accomplished at the cross. Jesus has made the way for us to sit before the Father without fear or shame. Guys, God is inviting us into communion with him today. God is there ready to listen. The question for us today will be how you respond to that invitation. Will you continue in guilt or enter into relationship through prayer? Because there's no guilt or shame in the gospel. God looks at you as blameless because of Jesus. Therefore, we can go to God with confidence. And let me let you in on a little secret. We can ask God for things. We can ask God for success in life like the servant. And God will hear us as long as it's in his will. 1 John 5:14 says, "And this is the confidence that we have toward him, that if we ask anything according to his will, he hears us." The servant believed God could accomplish this task for him, so he asked. And then when God responded, he responded in praise to the answered prayer. And again, I wish I could keep going. We actually are going to be talking about prayer starting in 2 weeks. We have a sermon series that we're going to do a deep dive into Psalm 1 and 2 for about 6 weeks. So if you're interested to hear more about prayer, come back. For now, we're going to keep going. And for the sake of time, I'm actually going to summarize from verse 29 to the rest of the chapter. So we see the servant, he actually goes to Rebecca's house and he meets her family. He tells them the whole story from the beginning to the end. He tells them about who he is. He tells them about Abraham. He tells them about the promises. He tells them about his prayers. And then he tells how Rebecca fulfilled his prayer. And after the servant finishes, here's the crazy part, telling the story, the family believes his word, blesses the marriage, and then sends her out. They even say a prayer over her of blessing. And this is verse 60. It says, "Our sister, may you become thousands of 10,000s, and may your offspring possess the gate of those who hate him." And after this, Rebecca and the servant leave to go to Isaac. Isaac and Rebecca meet, they get married, and the Bible says that Isaac is comforted by her after the passing of his mother. So this passage is the next step of the promise that God made to Abraham. It's the passing of the baton from Abraham to Isaac and Rebecca. And we can see that the point is the continuation of the promise by the fact that the chapter starts and ends with offspring. But then, what does that have to do with us? Like, how does this apply to our lives with offspring? Does that mean we're supposed to all have, like, 50 children? Like, get married and have 50 children? I hope not, because I'm not having 50 children. I'm just saying, that's crazy. But the more and more I read this, I saw the story unfolding that God is working in the world to bring a people to himself. For, yes, his glory, but it's also for our good. God worked through Abraham, a servant, Rebecca, and Isaac to deliver on his promise. And all those people had to do was believe and trust that he was working for the good and step out in faith. You know, he kept his promises. He gave Abraham a son. He gave them a land to inhabit. He gave Rebecca to Isaac, and he was with them always. Which let me say real quick, circumstances do not mean that God is for us or against us. I'm not proclaiming a prosperity gospel today. I'm not saying that if you trust God, he will give you everything you want. He's not a genie. You might not get that great job or that spouse or that house that you've always dreamed about. You know, sometimes God's plans are very hard. A lot of times they are. I mean, just take a look at the people in the Bible and how their lives were. It wasn't comfortable. We're not promised a comfortable life, but for those that have faith in Jesus, we are promised God. And God is for us, not against us. And we know this because of who God is and what he has done for us in the gospel. Do we believe that he is for us in our everyday lives? And that's where the rubber meets the road, right? Because if you're like me, you probably live the majority of your life trying to work out of your own ability. You go through the day not even stopping to think about what God would have for you that day. You walk through the day thinking your ways are the best, or at least you just think, I got this. I don't need God in this situation. I got it. I can do it. Or maybe you're on the flip side of that. Maybe you don't do much because you worry. Circumstances aren't happening fast enough or the way that you want them, so you worry that they're never going to happen. So you just don't do anything. You're paralyzed. In either case, maybe it's not a deliberate act against God, but it's certainly not actively pursuing a relationship with God in all aspects of your life. And what is happening in those times of your life is that you aren't believing that God is for you in all areas of your life. You're forgetting that He cares deeply about you and wants to walk alongside you at all times. God is for us, not against us, in both the things we can see and the things we can't see. Just some examples to put some meat on what I'm saying. And guys, I'm going to start with my own life here. You know, I'm a pastor of a church. I work for the church, right? So I want to see the church succeed and grow. And there are days when we plan and execute, and the church doesn't grow the way I want it to. It's easy in those times to start to worry about the church closing because we didn't grow. It's easy to start to think that maybe God isn't going to bless this church and think that one day the doors will close if we don't do something. And when I do that, I'm believing that success is in a growing church and that I'm responsible for its growth. In those moments, I'm forgetting why I'm a pastor in the first place. I'm a pastor because there is a God that is for us, a God that sent His Son to die for a people and bring them into fellowship with Him, which is what makes up the church, and that He is Lord over the church, not me. He knows His plans. It's not up to me to grow the church. It's my role to steward the church, and it's up to Him to take care of the rest. Singles in the room, I want to talk to you guys for just a second. I know it can be hard to be single when you desperately want to find someone to be with. And it can be easy to believe lies about your worth when you are single. It's easy to question why you are single in the first place and question God's plans. I recently read an article from a lady named Elizabeth Woodson about four popular lies about singleness. Okay, and the four lies are single equals alone, your value is in a role, marriage is guaranteed, and marriage equals happiness. And Elizabeth says in this article, and I want to just reiterate this back to you if you're single today. Those are just straight out lies. Your value is not found in being married. It's not found in a spouse or that relational status of yours. It's found in being a son or daughter of God. You are not alone. God doesn't promise that you'll find that perfect person to live the rest of your life, but He does promise to never leave you nor forsake you. He went to great lengths to make sure that you are not alone, that you know that you have value, and that you can have joy in life through Jesus. God is here for you. Lean into His promises. It's married people in the room. Hope is not in our marriages or in our children. Guys, marriage and children are amazing gifts from God. I love my wife and my kids. I'm so thankful for them. But often when circumstances happen with our spouse or kids, we question. You know, we get in a big fight with our spouse, or we go through a divorce, or a kid goes down a path that we don't wish them to go down, and we often question why it's happening. And what we're doing is questioning God's goodness to us in that situation. God doesn't promise that we will always have perfect marriages or perfect kids. But in those times that your marriage isn't perfect or your kids are going down a bad path, I just want you to hear that God's here for you. He is working even when you can't see it. And we know this by his word that for those that love God, all things work together for good. You can have joy and peace even in those circumstances because you have God and he is enough. Lean into his promises today. God created humanity in order to have a relationship with us. But because we don't believe that God's ways are the best ways, because we don't lean into his promises, we go our own way. We have broken the relationship by our sin, and that sin is putting ourselves and our ways before God. What we have done is made ourselves God. But I love stories like Isaac and Rebekah because it shows the great length in which God has gone to restore the relationship with us. He is working in time and space to bring us back to him. The gospel doesn't start when Jesus showed up in Bethlehem. It started back in the Garden of Eden. And God moves throughout the history of humanity to bring about restoration between him and us. You know, we've been talking about the main point of this chapter is the offspring. It's not about offspring in general. It's about the offspring. From Isaac and Rebekah would come children who had children, and eventually a couple in this line of descendants named Joseph and Mary would have an offspring named Jesus. You see, all this talk about offspring is just to point us forward to the offspring that would pour out his life for us. Jesus is the offspring that would be born, and he lived the life that we were supposed to. He was perfect. He always believed that God's ways were the best ways. Even when they were hard, even when it would cost him his life. In the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus knew that the time had come for him to take the punishment of the world upon himself. And he asked God to take the cup from him if it was in his will. But it was God's will that Jesus, this promised offspring, would go to the cross and take our place to pay the price for our sin, to give us life, to give his life for us and die the death that we deserved. Guys, here in a couple minutes, we're going to sing a song called The Cup Was Not Removed. The first couple of verses say the cup was not removed. He drank it all. See him hanging there where I belong. His tears were as scarlet, but there in the garden, the cup was not removed. We deserved punishment for going our own way, but God sent his beloved son to take our place. The promised offspring came into the world. He lived, he died, and he rose again so that we could be brought into the family of God. That's ultimately how we know that God is for us, not against us. Because Jesus, the promised offspring, gave his life for us. He bore it all on our behalf to give us life and have it more abundantly. This is why Abraham sent the servant. That's why the servant was to find a wife for Isaac. That's why Rebekah went to marry a man she didn't know. It's to fulfill the promise that God made to humanity to redeem and restore. Jesus is that promise. God is faithful to keep his promises. And to end today, guys, I just have one question for us. Do you believe that God is for you? Do you believe in the small things, in the big things, in the things that you cannot see? Do you believe that God is for us? Let's pray. Father, I just want to thank you for your grace. In no way do we deserve a relationship with you. We have gone our own way time and time again, but time and time again, you show up. I love the verse in Ephesians where it says, "But God, rich in mercy." Thank you for your mercy. Thank you for your love to us. Help us today to believe in every aspect of our life, whether it's something small like eating or drinking, or whether it's something big about what job to take, or maybe to marry somebody, or maybe it's to go overseas on mission. I pray that we would just see your goodness to us, and we would believe in your promises this week. Thank you for loving us. Thank you for your mercy. In your holy name. Amen.
Thanks so much for listening with us today. We hope that it was an encouragement to you. But you know, we don't see this as a replacement for gathering with other believers in a local church context. So if you don't have a local church, we would encourage you to plug in with one wherever you are. And if you're in Roanoke, Virginia, we'd love to invite you to plug in with us here at Redemption Church. And you're welcome anytime to gather with us. But you can check us out online at our website, redemptionroanoke.com. You can look for other content or resources there. But thanks again for listening.